Well, Michael Jones, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
One of the things that interests me about your approach to maps and mapping is that you don't even call a map, you call it a place browser. And it seems to me that that distinction underpins your philosophy to cartography. Could we start there? Why call it a place browser? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's an abstraction of what I see people do on the web. You know, you go to Google and you search for something, you're given links to web pages, and you click to follow those links, and you can drill down deeper and deeper and deeper to find what you want to know or things related to that. Basically, it's a starting point. It's not the destination, the Google search. And with Google Maps and Google Earth, it's the same idea. You type in a place, Darling Harbor, you zoom in, you may discover that there's a yacht show. You may discover what the cruise ship schedules might be. You might discover what the water taxi's like. That is, it's not just a map of Darling Harbor. It's the gateway to all the world's information about Darling Harbor, including photos people have taken, videos, restaurant menus, everything. And so in that sense, it's a browser for a place. The names of places are just the starting point, just the door.
And I know you've said in the past that when you're looking at information, you're not just interested in information for its own sake. You want information on your maps that's actionable. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I've said that, what I'm getting at is, for example, if you click on a restaurant, for example, my wife and I were just in Sydney recently and we wanted Thai food and we were guided to the best Thai restaurant in town, supposedly. But we couldn't make a reservation. We just found out the name of it. And so what I would like to have is a map like Google Map, which I found the restaurant quite successfully, even using my Android phone. But then once I find it, I want to say, do you have a table for two? And so I want to be able to find places and then do something about them. I want to see what's showing at the Opera House and make a reservation. I want to see what the schedule of the ferry is and reserve two seats or buy two seats. I think we expect that now online. We can go to stores and buy things. But I think sometimes on a map, you can just look. And I want you to look and touch and taste and see and feel.
So is what you do with Google Earth and Google Maps, is it really a continuation of the approach that was taken with search, that Google originally took with search that made it such a successful search engine in the first place?
Well, it is a continuation of the same thinking, and we hope it will be similarly successful over time. It's certainly done well in every country where it's been launched. People now, I think, when they see a map on a computer screen, they think if they were to click on it and drag their mouse, the map would slide. And that's only through the last few years of Google Maps that people have come to expect that. Others have copied it, but the point is the thinking about what a map can be has changed, and we showcase that way. And my hope is that by continuing to make maps in smarter and smarter places that you can browse, everyone will see a map that, if they see a paper map, they won't know why it doesn't do something when they touch it. And that's my goal.
When you talk to people in the field of cartography, very quickly, they mention that Google is the new player, the new big kid on the block. Do you see Google as the most important source of mapping information globally?
Google is a communicator. Google connects users, billions of users, with hundreds of billions of data sources. So our goal is to connect you. Just as Google Search, we aren't the website you go to. We're the website you go to find the website you want to go to, the document, the website, or so forth. In Maps, our goal is to connect with information. For example, in Google Maps, if you have turned on real estate, then you can zoom around anywhere in Australia and you can see all the apartments that are for rent, all the houses that are for sale. But when you click on one of those, it takes you to the sales site for the estate agent. It doesn't take you to Google. It's a communicator. It's a connector of people understanding information visually and then connecting them to the real estate agent. And so that process is what we see ourselves doing, and we do that more and more. It's similar to Google Maps. I think it's very important. It's what maps have never been and what they can be and what they need to be useful to people in a modern world.
It seems to me that Google's approach also blends the virtual and the real in a way that hasn't been done before or hasn't been done by the major map makers in the past. Would you agree with that?
What I think is important is to realize that the Earth, which is a fantastic thing, it is the home of all humans, and it's interesting. Every little inch of it is interesting for some reason or another. Places that weren't interesting before the earthquake in Christchurch are fascinating to people now when they look at New Zealand. Things that are where a big event happens in the history of Australia might not look like something special now, but it has a historical importance and significance. So every place, either back in time or at the moment or maybe in the future, is important to people. I think it's important to let people see that and really savor that moment, to really understand what's going on. And I think it's especially important to serve as a hub for other people's information. If you take vacation photos, then your photos can make the entire map of the entire Earth more valuable. I think that's good for everybody.
I'd like to get your comments on where you see Google heading in the future. I know that you've said that you don't want to develop a better Google Earth, but a smaller Google Earth. I take it that relates to the growth in mobile technology, in the way people are embracing smartphones.
That's right. Right now, all the things the internet has done, which have been fantastic, email and everything that people do love doing with computers on the internet, only is used by 22% of humans. 78% of people don't have internet access. But 4 billion of those people, twice as many as use the internet, have mobile phones. So if we can make their lives rich the same way the internet has made our lives rich in the United States and Australia and New Zealand and Germany and France, make everybody else's lives rich in the same way in Papua New Guinea and India and South America, we'll have done a great service to those people. And I think that's going to be through mobile phones. Phones will be so smart, better than any PC you ever owned, but still they're going to be inexpensive mobile phones. And the gateway that offers to people for education, understanding and travel and learning is so good that we should do our very best to make that wonderful and make it happen as soon as possible.
And in an article earlier this year, you also talked about a new application that you're working on called Starfinder. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it ships with Google Android phones now, and what's wonderful about that, it's a sort of a gateway to what's happening in the future. If you use this application on Google Android phones, basically, you turn it on, you hold your phone up at arm's length, then you wave your arm around up over your head or out in front of you to the right or left or behind you, look down at the floor. What you actually see are all the constellations and stars captured on that phone exactly as you would see them in that direction. So if you point at the sun, it says, it's a circle, it says, this is the sun. If you point at the International Space Station, it tells you that's the International Space Station or Venus or Mars. It also tells you about the Big Dipper, the Pleiades, and so forth. It, in context, it's just like maps are in context. This is all the world in context, but not by doing a textual search, but by pointing. So you point essentially your magic wand at the thing you care about, and it tells you about it. I find that to be a compelling use of computers, and I think it has a great application to other things. You might point your phone at a restaurant and have it tell you what the menu is. You might point your phone at an airplane and tell you what flight that is. It seems very interesting to search the world by looking at it.
And how far away do you see that sort of technology? I mean, I know other people are working on similar applications. When do you think it will, it will be a standard device?
Well, everybody's mobile phone can do it now that has an Android phone. So I think, and iPhone's equally capable, so all the smartphones have the power to do that. The real information is getting the data. So for Google Maps, it means crawling across the web. For Google Search. For Google Maps, it means buying data of roads and aerial photographs and street view and so forth. For pointing and telling, what we have to do is get data about what's inside the building. And for that, we've enlisted the aid of business owners all around the world to describe their place. There's a system where they can claim their place and they can say, this is my restaurant, and today's soup is chicken noodle and tomorrow's soup is tomato bisque. And they can change it whenever they feel like it. And that way, when people point a phone at their business, we'll be able to tell them what the soup of the day is.
Now, in terms of data collection and in terms of the geolocation aspects of mapping, as you'd be aware, there have been concerns expressed about privacy and the way in which data is being collected and why it's being collected and how it's being used. We spoke for our program last week to Professor Michael Goodchild from the University of California in Santa Barbara. He made the point that he thought that the new producers of maps like Google had still a way to go to establish trust with the community. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think it always is an ongoing effort to prove trust with people, especially when you're in the business of innovation. One of the things that rocks trust is change. Whenever things are different, then everybody wonders what they mean. And a lot of the things that we do are right at the edge of the possible. So you might say, Google has a new service to do this or that, and people say, I didn't know that was possible. Well, as soon as you realize that something new has happened that you didn't even know was possible before, you can't help but wonder, well, is that good? Is that bad? Does it have a good intent or poor intent? How will that affect me? Those are new questions. Those questions cause a thinking, which are good. It doesn't mean the thing is bad just because you think about it, but it makes you think about it. So I think trust is not something that we have and can attain in a way that dispels people's thought and wonder. I just think we need to be always so careful, always so honest, always so clear, that when people wonder, they can investigate and decide for themselves that things are okay. And that's the biggest thing. And I think from time to time we may make mistakes and we need to fix those as quickly as possible.
And the fears that people have, not just about Google, but about other online organisations and the way they collect data, how do you see those playing out? I mean, do you think people will become less fearful as time goes on, or is a certain level of distrust always going to be there?
Well, some people are certainly distrustful. I think that's true. But I think the real thing is that, like I said before, that all these things are so new that no one's really comfortable yet. It takes time for society to make a decision about what should be and shouldn't be, and more importantly, about what's right and wrong. An example that I like to think of just in my own life is a decade ago, I wouldn't have considered taking a camera into a public restroom for fear of being beaten. But now everybody takes mobile phones with cameras on them into public restrooms. And so you don't take them in there to take pictures of people, but it's normal as opposed to new and unusual. The first person to do it would have maybe been thought of as a pervert. And now that it's normal, it's just thought of as normal and nobody thinks about it. And I think when you are new with radio or television or cars, it just creates questions that people don't have answers to. Imagine if Google had just invented the map and there had never been a map before. The same people would have said, oh my goodness, everyone can see my house on the map. Well, of course they can, but they don't know it's your house. It's just a map of the whole country. So I think it's newness that scares people, and I think sometimes people use newness and people's frightened ability to actually do a kind of a mischief. I don't like that.
We heard on the program last week about the role that Google's taking on, in a sense replacing the map-making functions that a lot of government agencies around the world traditionally did. And in that context, some of the difficulties that Google's had in terms of managing the politics of that between different countries where it comes to the naming of particular areas. How big an issue do you see that for Google, and how much work do you think the organisation has in terms of diplomacy, in terms of trying to make money from searches, but also trying to avoid those sort of political tensions between rival nations?
Well, actually, that's an area where I spend a lot of time personally, and it's never been my desire to avoid political tensions in that regard. The thing that happens is that in the past, the biggest change because of Google's role in mapping is that in the past, every map maker was in a country, and they produced maps for some country. And say in the case of India and Pakistan, if you were in India, you made maps for Indian people to buy, and in Pakistan, you made maps for the Pakistan people to buy. And if your map was different than it would have been in the other country, nobody ever noticed because it was bought in your country. It was local. You could say what you wanted to that sold well to the home team, and nobody really ever questioned you. What Google has produced is a map of the earth, not a map of a country. It includes all the countries. So whenever countries are in harmony, then there is no problem. Whenever, for example, United States, when California agrees where the border is with the next state, the states don't go to war because they agree on where the border is. But in countries where they have an existing disagreement, and there are about 200 places in the world where countries disagree about the border, then what the Google map does is it just shows the disagreement. We say this is in the case of Pakistan and India, this is the line that Pakistan claims, and this is the line that India claims because we got them from those countries. And this is this other line that's part of a truce settled in a war. There's three lines there. They're labeled. You can click to see what the situation was. And that's fine in almost every country because, for example, almost everybody who disagrees with somebody is willing to tell you about it. But there are a few countries where even saying that somebody disagrees with the local political view is itself against the rules. And there's one country where it's a crime. And those are the only countries where we have problems, where telling the truth is a crime. But in most countries, it's not a problem at all.
And you don't see it being a significant problem for you in future years, in coming years?
No, I don't, because I think what happens is that we show the truth and we get the data from each country, and then if somebody wanted to complain about it, the only complaint they could have was that we're sharing the truth and educating the world to the facts as they are. That's a pretty difficult argument for an elected politician to make. It might not stop a dictator or someone elected through non-democratic means, but it wouldn't stop anybody who had to use reason as their argument. So I have not found it to be a problem. I think what does happen, though, and I personally deal with this, is that governments are curious. They want to know, what are you doing? How are you representing me? And it's just someone took a picture of you or your loved ones, and you said, well, what does it look like? Is it a good picture? So they want to know what we've done, and if we show a contended area, they basically, most of the time, when I talk to the king or the president or whoever, what they want to know is, that we didn't show the other side's point of view only, that we didn't take sides in the debate. They mostly are concerned that we are complete in our telling of the story, that there is a debate, when it started, what each side's point of view is, links to the UN articles of debate or the World Court debate, you know, whatever the facts are, as long as we communicate those to everybody unambiguously, then we're on the side of good, and almost every country appreciates that. I mean, there are five or six countries where they don't appreciate that, but, you know, I think it's fair to say that if you don't appreciate that, then you have bigger problems than Google.
And just a final question concerning the developing world and the potential that's there for Google to play a role. We talked earlier about the growth of mobile technology, and you mentioned some of the developing world countries where that's taken off in a very significant way. And this program has covered some of those developments in recent times. What potential, what opportunities do you see for Google applications in those developing worlds in terms of improving access to maps, access to information that can be used in map form?
Well, clearly, basic maps themselves are a starting point. In many countries of the world, what we find is that there really are no good maps in many countries of the world. If you were to make a list of 200 countries, you'd find that in maybe 50 countries there are good maps, and in another 50 countries there are bad maps, and in the bottom 100 countries on your list there are little or no maps at all. So the first step is just creating a national map, which is seen as a godsend by the people in the country. What we've done for that is we built a product called Google Map Maker, mapmaker.google.com. It lets you go and map out your country. And so people go to these tools, they use online on the web, and they draw roads. They look at satellite pictures and they draw roads. They put names on the roads. They highlight churches, schools, mosques, cemeteries, businesses. They put in phone numbers. So they basically create a living map. We have 146 countries where people are describing their country road by road by road. We've got 500 million edits from people around the world who are busy mapping out their own country. That's the first step, is just helping them have a real map. And the fact that it's done by people, as based on experience, means that when roads close or when roads are rerouted or when there's a construction project or an accident, they're able to mark that. So the driving directions we get are live with latest updates and information. So that's often used in disasters. Now, that's one way that I think our technologies, our mapping technologies, can help people in these countries. And another one is that we also connect people in the countries with the rest of the world. Sometimes people, and I visit these countries, countries like Togo and Ghana and Central African Republic, they feel pretty removed from the rest of the world. But we have examples where people use Google Maps to share the people, their culture, their lifestyle. You know, please visit us. We're friendly people. Here's what we do. We make these baskets. And it really helps their economy, and it helps their people be part of the larger world, which builds bonds of friendship. I think that's maybe the lasting benefit.
Well, Michael Jones, Chief Technology Advocate for Google, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.